Okay, we are back. Welcome to episode 34 of the Corporate Real Estate Insider podcast. To start us off today, John is going to share a story. He is a friend that has a company who is a tenant that nearly got completely screwed on a renewal. So let's hear what happened and how you fixed it.
Oh, it's in process. So to take a step back and talk about renewals generally, it's one of the most interesting parts of this work that we do. And in particular, because here's the way I say it. 9 times out of 10, the tenant doesn't want to move. And 10 times out of 10, the landlord knows it. So they're sort of captive. Like, we all get that, right? And so it's crazy. I think commercial real estate is the only industry that I'm aware of where long-term loyal customers are expected to pay a premium, like a loyalty premium. How crazy is that? And so we talk about that all the time. And, you know, we do have a role to play there when we can help a company to renew a lease. But then this little story happened, and it's just such a perfect illustration of what I'm talking about, where a friend of mine, it's a really smallish lease, and he thought it was too small to get me involved. And so he just reached out to the building owner, and he's been in the building for 15 years. He was going to do another 5-year term and got a quote for a renewal at a 290 rental rate. That's monthly per square foot. And, this guy had his son go ahead and call a friend of his who works at another commercial real estate firm. So have your buddy call, and because there's a vacant space like right next door, and talk to the listing agent, see what he quotes for rent. And they call, and the listing guy's like, yeah, $250 a foot. When can we set up a tour? And they're like, $250 for that guy, but $290 for us. What gives? And so they got me involved, and I'm working to unwind that now. But it just points to this idea that, and look, we talk about the conflicts of interest with the full service brokers when they're representing tenants. And I'm always quick to point out, it's not the people that are bad. Like, some of my best friends are at the full service firms, actually doing tenant representation at the full service firms. It's not the people that are bad. It's the model that's broken. And I think if we look at the math on this little anecdote I have, it is compelling. For example, maybe the tenant actually thought they were saving a 4% tenant side commission by dealing directly with the landlord. And the landlord comes back and proposes a 16% increase in rent. Ugh. Just brutal. Okay, let's do a little bit more math, and then I'll stop my rant and let you all chime in. But if we, so it's a 40 cent per square foot increase, 290 over 250. And if he could pull that off, which often landlords do. Oh, but another key point here. Look, our partner, David Marino, just wrote an article in Forbes talking about this dynamic where suddenly the office market is 30% availability rates, just crazy new pricing, right? And yet across the country, largely landlords haven't reduced their asking rental rates. So there's this mystery around where rents are supposed to be today. And that's what we're talking about. So in this example of a 40% premium, if that guy could get it, for example, over 150,000 foot medical, multi-tenant office building, 40 cents per month is 480 per square foot a year. Let's call it a 7 cap. In today's market, divided by 0.07, that's $68.57 in value creation if you can pull it off. Oh, by the way, that's 150,000 square feet, $10.285 million in value creation. Like, the temptation is just too high if a tenant is captive and unknowing, unsuspecting, asking rents haven't moved. You know, who's telling them that? No, in fact, there's a very different story at play in the market today. And I just thought that that story, that anecdote, was really illustrative of what's happening in the market and the tenant side broker imperative that we see today.
Yeah, I'll weigh in because this is kind of gets to the heart of what we do. And, you know, what I've done for tenants for over 20 years is, like, it is take the emotion out of it, take the personal relationships out of it. The responsibility of that owner is to get the highest rent. They have a responsibility, not to their tenants, but to their investors, to their family, to their wife's husbands, whoever owns the building with them. Their responsibility is to maximize the return. That's what they agreed to do when they took their money and invested it. Just like any, you know, anyone who invests in the stock market, like, companies are not going to sacrifice value for because you've been a partner of theirs for many years. It's just, it's against their fiduciary responsibility. So they're doing everything right. What they also are responsible for is to keeping the building full. So they have the ability to negotiate. You just need to have data and facts and someone who is knowledgeable enough on the process to be able to negotiate it for you. And that's what we do. It's not that people, landlords, are the big bag boogeyman. They just have a different set of rules and responsibilities than tenants. It's exacerbated today because real estate has moved away from its fundamentals, in which the fundamentals are that tenants create all the value, to today where the financing has created all the value. Real estate became a asset that has been traded extensively, playing arbitrage in the financial markets to create value. And that has eroded what the underlying value is of the tenant. We're back to tenants create all the value. And unfortunately, right now, we're in a position where many owners cannot negotiate in current markets. We have, you know, vacancy rates that are 20, 25% or more, but the true underlying occupancy rates, take away the availability that we talk about as real estate professionals. Look at occupancy. Across the board, occupancy is less than 50%. If you average it out over 5 days, which is the traditional sense, it's significantly below that. So real estate values have fallen off a cliff. And right now, it's hard to capture that because there's long-term leases. There's still stability in the market. It's a trailing indicator of value because leases are in place. But you need people to be pushing this now, just like your case, or you're just allowing a different set of responsibilities and motivations drive the process, which is okay if you want to allow that. It's not like anyone's doing anything wrong. But it's just not aligned to what your needs are.
You know, what's happening in the current market is tremendous uncertainty. And you alluded to it. Some of the landlords can't actually afford to meet the market today because it's below a level that would support their existing financing, their existing loan. So what do you do then, right? But it's just this idea that I think our rule has actually changed a bit in that now we are and need to be the market maker. These negotiations become price discovery negotiations. Comps are meaningless. They're looking back to a time that no longer exists. So what's the new market rent? Like, we need to figure it out. And what happens if the market rent is below a level that the current landlord can sustain or afford to transact? Yeah, right? What do we do then? Do we wait? Do we capitulate? Do we compromise? Do we move? Anyway, price discovery negotiations, suddenly we're market makers. I mean, when I say we, I mean all tenant side brokers, and hence the reason for that article I've written. It's not published, it will publish soon. The tenant side broker imperative. It's never been more crucial, the role of the tenant side broker in this market to figure things out.
Yeah, John, I think you're right. And sorry to jump on anyone who was jumping in here, but the key to that, though, because I'm dealing with it where you've got an inexperienced broker who is pushing everything to the point where the deal's going to fall apart, right? So you need to be a market maker, but you have to know where the deal has to land. Even in a market where, you know, it's a significantly below what a landlord broker will tell you is market. But this particular person here in Boston is just pushing and pushing and pushing, and they don't really understand where the breaking point is, and they're advising their client to the point where the deal is going to fall apart. Now, in the case of a renewal, this is not a renewal. This is a sublease, and we represent the sublandlord, and the sublandlord is going to wait for the next deal because it's just unreasonable. And the client really wants the space, I think. So it's unfortunate. And maybe they come back and they backpedal, and the broker looks bad, which they should. But at some point, there's a breaking point, and you have to be good enough to understand it. But in the case of a renewal, it gets more concerning because landlords, smartly so, they look at, and this is, I think, how many of them justify these deals. They don't look at your renewal as this is the rent to me. What they do, and I've been in the room representing tenants, their model shows this is what it would cost you to move. And this is what your P&L cost would look like if you move. It's not, here's my rent versus your rent. It's, here's my rent as is because you like your space. You've already paid for all that. You already built it all out and it's your money, but I'm taking the value of it. Versus this is what it would cost you in rent. And here's all the capital you'd have to throw into that new deal to move. Why would you ever move? It's going to cost you 1.5 times, 2 times X on a 5-year deal because construction pricing is so expensive right now. Why would you ever move? I deserve to charge you more because you're getting the benefit of all these in-place improvements. Well, sorry, I put those improvements in. It was my money 5, 10, 15 years ago to build it. Maybe you contributed, but at the end of the day, I've been keeping it up. I've been improving it. I've been updating the IT. I've been doing all the refreshes. But the landlords want the value of that. And their model truly includes that. And that's how they compare where they can set rents on a renewal versus a relocation. And it's hard to unwind that because they're right in a certain sense. It is more expensive to move right now. And that's why the majority of people are renewing. And it becomes this conversation on, okay, where is the acceptable line to be drawn? Now, the benefit we have right now is that usually when you do move, you can take significantly less space. So the math starts to turn in your favor with the efficiencies you can drive towards when you're building space.
There's sort of two ways to think about these transactions, right? You can think about it from the perspective of the tenant, or you can think about it from the perspective of the landlord. And fundamentally, there is a massive landlord bias in this industry because the vast majority of the people that work in the industry work on primarily landlord-centric models, right? Most of these big brokerage firms getting 80, 90% of their revenue from representing institutional landlords, of course, they have a landlord bias in how they look at things. And as Brian said, the reality in today's market is that the landlords have much, much more to lose in terms of increased capital costs, downtime, interruption of cash flow than tenants generally do in the form of having to pay for relocation costs. And part of that is driven by being able to take less space in the event that you do relocate, creating a monthly savings model because you're paying on less square footage. And it also has to do with the availability of sublease space, which is in great supply in virtually every single market. And that really drives down your cost to relocate. So when you look at this equation of who has more to lose, who has more at stake, yes, it does cause interruption and cash flow and all that for a tenant to leave, but it causes way, way more interruption for the landlord. And people need to be looking at this in an objective way and recognize that it's usually going to be far less expensive for the tenant to move than it is going to be for the landlord to not provide insanely compelling economics to keep the tenant in place.
I agree entirely. And at the risk of giving away the playbook, it's really pretty simple, right? What I always say is trust the process and keep an open mind. Like let's run a robust ethical process of evaluating the alternatives and alongside what staying would look like. And if you really go into that with an open mind, that's all it takes. It's amazing how far introducing just a little bit of uncertainty into that process goes towards bringing the current landlord to the table in a competitive way. And by the way, those highly specialized, expensive tenant improvements, when we are moving out, now that becomes an even bigger burden on the landlord who's going to have to tear them all out and start over with a full building redo. And in this market, maybe 12 to 18 months of downtime or longer. And who do they get as a tenant and their financial strength? I mean, the landlord has an equivalent, at least equivalent set of risk and cost profile on relocation. So I say the same thing every time. Just let's run a process. It's never just a renewal and it's never just a relocation. We're always considering, the full 360 degrees of alternative outcomes. Trust the process. The process will determine the winner. I don't know going into it. It's never just a renewal. Trust the process and let that drive the outcome. And that's really go into it with an open mind and that's all it takes.
Yeah, I found and this is a broad brush, but I've found in my career that the tenants that typically are most susceptible, would be the word I used, are most likely to work directly with landlords are the smallest tenants because they, like you said, John, they don't want to bother anybody. Like, I'm not big enough for a broker, which is certainly not the case. Everybody, deserves to be represented. And also the largest tenants, the ones that are full building users or have multiple buildings, in a portfolio or campus or something. And for a totally different reason, I think landlords put massive amounts of time, energy, and resources into trying to build very strong relationships with their biggest tenants for the right reasons, but also to be able to introduce, hey, why don't we just, you know, tack on some years to this term here? It's, oh, you want some cash? We can give you some cash. You know, just very opportunistic. At the same time, have built over long periods of time very good relationships, and they put their best people in positions to get to know these tenants. They put a lot of emphasis on their overall teams to deliver a high level of service. And you hear about these deals in the marketplace, you know, 5 years early doing extensions on leases. One that just came to mind downtown Boston of a very large lease and a tenant that was 5 or 6 years away added 10 years of term to it. Like, oh, we're not going anywhere. You know, this is a good opportunity to save a little bit. And they just went and did the deal directly. And so I found, and there's another one that we're talking to right now as a team, that's a very large tenant that's, you know, the answer was it's a high likelihood we're just going to work directly. And it's, we're going through that education process right now with this particular leadership team. And it's, it'll be interesting to see where that one falls out. But it's, you know, landlords are smart and they focus on what's important to them. And if they're delivering a very high level of service, it's hard to sometimes convince tenants that, you know, the deal on the table isn't the best thing for them.
All right. Well, we ran that to the ground. Let's change the subject here. I think it was our last pod. We talked about St. Louis and the doom loop that it finds itself in. There was that building that sold for $3 million or so that was once valued over $200 million in 2006. It was the former AT&T headquarters in St. Louis. But there was an article about a week ago about Detroit. And I think even before the pandemic, anyone on this listening to this pod, less those that might live in Detroit, would think when you said the word Detroit, they would just be like, ugh. You know, not that it isn't a city to be reckoned with as a place to live, but more so just like what's happened to the American car manufacturers, you know, those like GM and Ford. And what's happened is rather remarkable. And it was reported on the Wall Street Journal. And it was basically an article. The author, his thesis was there is a way to reverse the doom loop. And we all know even before the pandemic, many people would consider Detroit was in a doom loop. And, you know, during the pandemic or even before, they started investing into sports and entertainment. So the Detroit Tigers got a new stadium. There's the Lions have a great place to play as well. And the city started investing in those things that would bring people into the city. But there really wasn't anything to get people to stay in the city. Well, it just so happens that the market has started to take off. And even, you know, since 2020, home prices are up 40% in the area. Last year was the steepest rise among any U.S. Metropolitan area. The number of apartments downtown has soared, more than doubled since 2010. But the question's like, why is this all happening? What's going on? Well, there's a gentleman named Dan Gilbert. He owns the Cleveland Cavaliers. I think he's the majority owner. He's also a Detroit native, and he founded Rocket Mortgage, which is Quicken Loans, same company. He has really taken it upon himself to revitalize Detroit. And he's, in fact, right now, in partnership with a developer called Bedrock, is developing a new project that if you go to Detroit right now, it will be the largest tower or second tallest tower in the skyline at 681 feet. And it's a multi-use project. And indicative of the success that they're having, they've already landed Detroit's first Gucci store. Now, if you told me, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, that Detroit would be home to a flagship Gucci store, I would say you are out of your mind. But that project has landed not only Gucci, it's landed Lululemon, Nike, H&M, and other brands that, you know, I imagine, you know, some of you don't know, but like Shinola Watches, Warby Parker, the people that make glasses, and those are all the retail tenants. But this project is really cool, and it's a mixed-use development, and I think it's kind of indicative of what we're going to see in the future in terms of like what gets developed and how do you get people to activate a downtown. But it's this massive tower next to a smaller podium tower, and the primo space that at the top of the building is all multifamily. It's not the office. The office is more on the podium building, which is next door, which is, you know, a third of the height. They've already landed a massive lease with General Motors, who's leaving their current General Motors building. They're not selling it, but they're working with Bedrock to try and figure out how they're going to redevelop it. And there's activity. And I just think that this is a great example of people betting on downtown, reinvesting in their communities, saying, hey, we're not going to go out to the suburbs and do a, you know, a two-story, you know, multi-building campus, you know, 30 minutes outside Detroit. We are going to invest in downtown. And all these empty office buildings, or once empty office buildings, is really what kind of created this opportunity for Dan Gilbert and Hudson and Bedrock, who are really the ones developing all this, all these new buildings. And Hudson, by the way, is the name of the new project. I'm not referring to Hudson Properties. Bedrock is the developer. And so the one thing I will admit, which I kind of leaned into this a little bit over the weekend, all these office buildings that have now been reconverted to apartments were a bit unique in the sense that a lot of them were built a long time ago. So smaller floor plates. We've talked on earlier podcasts about the challenge of converting office buildings into multifamily, and it really requires a smaller floor plate. Because once you get to these big, more modern sized floor plates, which are 20 to 30, sometimes 40, 50,000 feet, it's really hard to multi-tenant for a multifamily kind of footprint where the depths from the core area where the elevator is to the window line are so long and so big. You'd end up with like a small bowling alley if you were to design an apartment with access to the common areas. Anyway, I just bring this up because I was rather intrigued when I read this article. It gave me hope for other cities around downtown. Even the University of Michigan has poured in a big investment into downtown, opening a research center, an educational center in downtown Detroit. So you've got a public-private partnership here. You've got executives that believe in the long game in Detroit, and with all of the, you know, multifamily going up and everything else that's going along downtown, it's really got some wind in the sails. So there's no question it still has a long road ahead of it. It's still plagued with a lot of office vacancy, like rest of the country is across all metropolitan markets. But if you had told me, you know, 5-10 years ago that this would be happening in Detroit, and you know, big name brand companies such as Ford and General Motors would be leasing space in downtown versus going out into the suburbs, and you'd have retailers like Gucci betting on downtown, I wouldn't have believed you. So I'm rather intrigued and excited. And maybe this is a blueprint for other cities to follow as we emerge into, you know, a new landscape for downtowns.
That's a great story, Owen. Lot to unpack. I think, you know, not to rattle people a bit, but when I read the article, it brought back the notion that it needs to get really, really bad before everything reprices so you can start to see this investment actually work, right? So Deloitte, people were buying stuff at bargain basement prices for decades to set the table to be able to make it work at the scale that it's working now, which is, to me, really scary in the sense that if Detroit's the blueprint, we need things in a lot of cities to get really bad. I mean, the Rust Belt cut really bad for a long time. I would tell you, I was there, I was trying to figure it out in my head, but I was there last, which is crazy, I think 8 years ago, and it could be 9. And it was amazing the amount of residential development that was taking place at that time or slated to take place. We were doing a survey for a client who had a pretty big requirement, and you'd point at different sites downtown. It was like, that's going resi, that's going resi, that's going resi. Some of it was under construction. A lot of it was just being permitted. A lot of it was just off the market, you know, being tied up. But there was a lot of investment even then into the residential sector. And if you bring the people first, then, you know, then all the businesses want to be there too, right? So they want to be where their people are. And the, you know, the concept of that podium office is awesome. I was in Vancouver. That's the first place I've known that have required some of their residential developers. I don't know if it's all of them or what scale, but I know the projects I was thinking about, they're requiring their residential developers to include podium office because they want people to work there, not just live there. So their issue is just the opposite of a lot of other markets where their people are being required to build residential if they're allowed to build office. And I guess Vancouver's been well ahead of that, requiring their residential developers to build office in the low rise of the podiums, which is pretty interesting to think about how, you know, how far ahead they were in that strategy.
I find it shocking that a government would require a developer to build more office space right now. And then you look around and wonder why Canada and Vancouver and Toronto have such a terrible reputation for wildly expensive housing. And maybe it's because they have all of these random requirements like, hey, if you're going to build apartments, you need to build, you know, two or three floors of office space that maybe no one's ever going to occupy. So you have to carry it in your model. It seems very weird to me.
To Brian's point about things having to get really bad before things start to get better, you know, I think you also have to talk about the scale at which you have to do things. Like Bedrock, the developer in Detroit, who partnered with Dan Gilbert, who again, who owns the Cavaliers and Rocket Mortgage, because they've invested over $7.5 billion since 2011, acquiring more than 140 properties in Detroit and Cleveland. And some of which are literally the most iconic buildings in those markets, not to mention they're building another 21 million square feet of office, retail, residential, industrial, hospitality, parking, et cetera. So it's not only like, yes, they were presented an opportunity to buy things at severe discounts relative to maybe where they were once, but they're doing it at scale. And when you do things at scale, you can, you know, control the narrative, so to speak, for lack of better words. And I think that's really what they've done very well. And it remains to be seen how these things lease up, of course. But so far, their success is catching some headlines.
Yeah, Tucker, on the surface, I think you make a good point. I would tell you that people are gravitating to newly constructed offices. And in a market where residential is very expensive, but it's also in high demand, these governments are looking at it to how do we create a sustainable ecosystem where people want to live, they work, and they spend their time long term. I think having too much of one or the other is not good. And maybe it does cost a little more for the developers up front, but long term, having a strong ecosystem that provides for offices, for residential. I don't think this is the biggest hurdle in terms of their development concerns. There's a lot of factors, but I thought it was a good thing because it puts the offices where people live. And if you think about where are you seeing the greatest return to work in the United States, it's in these mixed use environments, the Brooklyns of the world, the seaports of Boston, because people live there. And not only people live there, the younger workforce lives there. And, you know, Detroit's spending billions and billions of dollars to bring these companies along. And the companies are, my guess is they're the last piece. They brought the residential first, and then the office workers come when the people live in there.
I meant to comment on Vancouver. It's so close to Seattle. I kind of follow it and spend a bunch of time up there intermittently working on transactions. And the pricing in Vancouver is really a result of them having so many offshore investors invest in multifamily, in real estate in downtown. So much so that I'm not sure if our listeners know, but effective January 1 of 23, they actually banned foreign investment, in downtown multifamily. Because you'd go downtown, I'd spend the night on a work trip and I'd look out my hotel window and you see these dark towers. A lot of them were apartments or condos rather that were owned and never occupied. And that ban expires January 1 of 25. It remains to be seen if it gets extended. But it got so bad, that's why prices were going crazy, because foreign investors were paying whatever they wanted to for these properties. And it priced out the local market so much so that literally they had to ban foreign investment for 2 full years. It expires in 6 months.
So going back to what Brian was saying, I agree that from an urban planning standpoint, having more mixed use would be great. When you're talking about like designing a next generation city, like imagine if you could, rebuild New York, all the changes that you would make and how awesome a city could be if it were done really intentionally with, you know, the thoughtfulness around mixed use and all that. I think my negative reaction to this requirement in Vancouver is probably because I am very jaded by living in Los Angeles or in California in general, where we have such this crazy housing problem in Los Angeles, yet the city council and county supervisors, all that, the reaction here is, instead of, hey, let's make it easier to build housing, it's let's make it way more challenging, way more expensive, and then complain every single day. Why aren't these developers building more housing for free when their tenants don't need to pay rent? They can't evict them. They can't adjust rents to market, and on and on and on. You know, as all of our listeners would imagine, you know, the four of us have lots of friends in all different segments of the real estate ecosystem, including many housing developers. And you talk to these guys and they're just besides themselves of how is this possible? How does this make any sense? If you want more housing, make it lucrative to build housing. Don't make it more challenging. Like, don't increase the amount of parking that's required, or, you know, some other arbitrary requirement, like needing to have 10% of your square footage be office space, for example. So that's probably where my pessimism comes from. Although I do agree that if we could go back and redesign cities, we can make downtowns way, way more cool.
It was a really good article, and I wish I had more details on it, but I don't. But it was on this exact point, and we should talk about it on a later pod. But the premise of the article was, if you want to have housing, make it easy and less expensive to build it. So they talked about Austin, and rental rates in Austin are plummeting. And there's a number of reasons, right? People have moved a little bit out of the city as tech has diminished their requirements to be in the office, but rents are plummeting. But they've removed parking requirements for new developments. They streamlined the permitting process for new developments, and a ton of, if you go down there, it looks like the building is just, the city is just being built all at once. And there's already a ton of housing there, but it's all new residential development going up. And the city really made a focus on this, and it was able to get rents to the trajectory is down. I think they're down like something like 30% right now. And don't quote me on that, but it's massive reductions in rental rate, asking prices over the last, say, 12 months because of a lot of new projects coming online.
I was going to volunteer, since you're bringing up civic design and planning and urban centers and how you would redesign in Manhattan if you could start from scratch today. There was a story that came out over the weekend in San Diego, where it would be our version of the Big Dig, except there wouldn't need to be a bunch of digging. It's the Highway 163 that leads north out of downtown San Diego, which is in this really naturally occurring steep sort of little ravine or valley through Balboa Park. And the discussion now, area business leaders are trying to convince the city to potentially cover that and effectively put the 163 underground and capture what would be new buildable land. And you could structurally support it, so you could actually go high-rise residential on top of this structure. But really interesting to think about what used to be this deep ravine where the 163 went could be an underground highway and buildable, or parks and open space. Why not? It's in the middle of Balboa Park. But super interesting as a creative change to the urban plan for downtown San Diego.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything in the last, you know, I don't know, at least my lifetime that I could think of on scale that competes with the value the Big Dig brought to the residents of Boston. And they built it not for the residents. They built it because of the traffic patterns and submerging all the highways, but also creating a lot more capacity in the highway system to the airport. You know, our highways weren't even connected to the airport. It was really bad, but it was this elevated system that opened up so much green space. And the city was smart. It developed a lot of the parcels, but it also put a lot in conservancy, donated it to a nonprofit, and it's been massively changed how this city feels, walks, and operates because of its connection to the waterfront and just removing that highway. It's amazing. And the park that it created is just awesome. So, and it's, what's funny is on scale, I think they bid it at $14 billion, right? Just think, what can you build now for $14 billion? And this submerged, like, it took 20 years, massive amounts of highway, couple tunnels under the water, $14 billion. It actually came in around, I think, double that, $22, $24 billion. And it was this huge scandal that it cost so much money. Like, you couldn't move one of those roads for double that now. You know, it's just amazing what how far costs have risen over, what has it been, 30 years since the big dig. So just perspective is everything, I guess.
So let me reset. And I don't mean to pick on these folks, the brokers or the owners. It's just a really interesting microcosm, I think. When it first came out, I asked the question. It's a 123,000 square foot building, fully leased to Amazon for 5 more years. They've been in the building for 10 or 15 years. The listing guys suggest that the current rent is 17% below market rents, and the current owners want to sell it as a lease investment. And I think when we did this previously, there was no asking price. And I posed to the group the question of, you know, what does it sell at? And what's the cap rate for 5 years of Amazon term and when they may or may not renew? And I think it was you, Brian, that suggested it was unsaleable or effectively unable to be sold in the current market climate. Well, anyway, here's a quick update. It is still for sale. Has now been on the market for 47 days. It now has an asking price of $247 a foot, which is an 8.75 cap rate. Let's continue to watch this space. And they may surprise us. I think I did say previously, and I'll say again, I think it will sell. I don't know what the number will be. I think it will be maybe a significantly higher cap rate than that ask. And the buyer will be someone local, a builder, a developer, somebody who knows Tempe. And when this gets to a price that is, in their minds, below replacement costs and includes a little bit of carry in case the building goes vacant, it'll be a local buyer. Either that or it doesn't sell. And the current owners just have to enjoy the lease and bear the risk of Amazon not renewing, or maybe they renew and the current owners do just fine. So anyway, that's the update. I'll continue to watch that space.
I wouldn't want to be an investor in the company that ends up buying it. I would tell you, there's been a few sales here in Boston, and the profile of the buyer is they create a lot of value to the investors, or at least the holding company that solicits the investors by collecting fees, right? So they're somewhat, unfortunately for probably the investors at the end of the day, in my opinion, they're somewhat unsensitive to value because they want brokerage fees, asset management fees, property management fees, probably some other fees that are missing in there. So they're buying when they see a value get down below replacement cost or significantly below previous trades, they're buying stuff and just, you know, collecting fees and hoping and praying. But I'm not surprised it hasn't sold yet.
Yeah, when you're only 1% or 2% of the total equity in the project, you're incentivized to take these very volatile swings, right? Go way far out on the risk curve where you're either going to have a home run type of deal, right? Say Amazon re-signs that lease for 10 or 15 years. All of a sudden, you've created a massive amount of value in a very short period of time. So that's path one. If that were to happen, which I think given what Amazon's doing with its office space and the occupancy of this building and things like that, probably very unlikely. But if it happens, it's a home run. And if it doesn't happen, then probably under almost all situations, unless you're buying at a super low price, you're going to have an empty building and you're going to have a full equity wipeout. And you start thinking, like, why would people take these risks? Well, if you're getting a, you know, percentage of the upside and you don't really have a percentage of the downside because you don't have skin in the game and you're collecting fees the entire way, then it makes sense. Whoever syndicates that deal is going to be able to make a lot of money, but it's going to be probably at the great cost to their investors.
Yeah, I'm going to change gears. And there's a really interesting, and this gets to a different side of the business that's just, we've talked about a lot, but not from maybe from this perspective. But there was an interesting article. So General Electric, you know, the conglomerate that once was one of the most admired companies, probably in the world, one of the most admired CEOs and Jack Welch in the world. And everybody knew GE, either in their kitchen or, you know, in their traveling on airplanes to locomotives to GE Finance when they're going to buy a car. And it's a big, very different company today. And there was just an announcement earlier this month that they sold their 60-acre campus in Groton-ville, which is just about an hour outside of New York City, for $22 million. And this wasn't a office park. This was a training and a collaboration center for their people. So this is where the legendary GE training program started. This is where Jack Welch would visit and give presentations on a very frequent basis, at least once a month. And it was kind of the basis of what formed what many believed as the best trained managers in the industry, in a lot of industries. And it just sold. So Jack Welch's wife, Susie Welch, who is a professor at NYU, wrote a opinion piece in the journal this week, which I thought was just so interesting, about Crotonville. And it was titled Crotonville and the Death of Fun at Work. And the one piece that I thought was really interesting was when she invited a guest speaker into one of her lectures. And this kind of brings you back to Crotonville. This woman's name was Emily Field, and she was a partner at McKinsey. And the presentation was on managerial skills. And she had co-authored a book called Power to the Middle, Why Managers Hold the Key to the Future of Work. And during the question and answering session, a student asked about motivation. And after, and what her reply was, managing people is hard because to do it right, you have to authentically care about them. On some level, management is about love. And this is a conversation around, you know, you can love your company and love the people that work there. It is one and the same at times. And apparently during the conversation, they looked up and it was just an entire class of just mortified faces. And some of the feedback that people started having is, you know, I'll just read the quotes. You need to keep boundaries at work. You can't trust your boss. Companies don't love you. They use you. And on and on and on. And it was kind of mortifying to, you know, to Susie Welch and to the other professor in the class. And it just goes to show you, which makes it so interesting, it just goes to show you how the employer and the employee relationship has changed since a place like Crotonville was built, and how it was a reward for a company to bring their managers here to learn, to grow, and to be more ingrained into the culture or on a process to become a more senior leader in that organization. And she brought it over to that exact point. Handshake, a job site solely for college students and recent college grads, did a survey of 2,500 undergrads. They asked their definition of career success. 78% of them said sustaining a work-life balance was their top choice. Dead last at 40% was advancing to a senior role within the organization. And it's kind of sad because, you know, where does that leave us in 10 years? Where does that leave us in 20 years with, you know, with people coming to the office, with people in the United States and America being the leader in innovation, leader in technology, the leader in, you know, manufacturing advancements? When you don't have a workforce that views work the same way, it can be pretty scary.
I love it. Love is a competitive advantage. Brian Connolly went there. I know we don't want to promote internal, you know, but this may have been before you joined the company, but we do talk about love around here. And by the way, love you, podcast bros.
This is right up your alley, John. I knew it. And, you know, it hits differently because it's, you see, you know, I was listening to an interview this morning, and it was this, this gentleman by the name of Bruce Ratner. And if anyone doesn't know Bruce Ratner, Forest City, the real estate development company, huge residential, mixed-use developer, was originally called, Forest City Ratner, I believe. And he is, you know, he is a philanthropist. He's just wrote a book. And they asked him in the interview about the office market. And he said, look, office is dead. He said, and this is his perspective, New York City. He says it's dead. 25% vacancy rate doesn't tell you the story. He said that no one's coming back to the office. Occupancy levels are below 50%. People don't want to work in an office anymore. He said the majority of this the office product in New York City is going to get knocked down and turned into residential. Now, coming from the perspective of a developer of residential. But his perspective is telling in the sense that like people don't have pride in their company. They don't view working at a company as being the definition of success. They view success at an 80% clip of having balance. Balance is not spending 2 hours commuting into New York City each way to work in Manhattan. That's the old way. That is the 40% that used to be 80% that wants to have, career success and advancement within an organization. Those are the people that did that. Today, people want to work from home. They want to commute into the city as little as possible. And the real estate market is being slowly drawn or driven towards that death.
I totally don't agree. Come on, man. There are so many counterexamples. I mean, you make it sound universally true, and it just isn't. There are a lot of companies thriving in person. There are some insisting on in person. There are some for whom the rewards of a hard day at work are worth it. So there are so many counterexamples where people are heading in. What you're describing is happening, but it's not played out. And I've said from the beginning, and I'll say it again, my theory of the case is as follows. There, over time, you will see that the companies that come together in person have stronger cultures. They know one each other. They like one another. They dare say love one another. They spend this time together. There's nothing like the in-person experience. And those companies will win in a competitive marketplace. And the companies that think they can do the same while everyone's sitting in their bedroom on a laptop, it's just not the same. So over time, I predict that the in-person will drive improved culture, which will drive winning in the marketplace, and we'll see more people coming together to work. It'll be some new version of normal, and maybe it's not 5 days a week, 8 to 6 commuting an hour and a half each way, but coming together is a superpower. That'll be borne out over time.
I'm going to kind of disagree with both you and agree with both you in some respects, not for the sake of just hearing myself talk, but I know for a fact there are companies, they're here in downtown Seattle, a COO of a large five floor tenant, so about 100,000 feet, I won't name who they are, toured me through his entire office 2 weeks ago, and it was buzzing. Because, why? They require everyone to come in 5 days a week. Five! And this is a technology company that everyone on this pod would know about, okay? But they're an anomaly right now. I would be the first to say that. They are. And I also have my best friend in the world who is a CEO and founder of multiple companies. He's on his latest company, and they are a remote first company, and they are kicking butt. They're thriving, and they have some of the top venture capitalists who have invested in their company. I won't name who those are, but I'm talking like the best in the country. Okay. So it is not stopping them from raising money. It is not stopping them from thriving. So there's something that works for everybody. And I'm not just saying like, oh, we're going to be in this kind of like quagmire of like remote work versus in-office work. But I think to John, your point, like companies will find what works for them. I do believe there's a point in being together. We do our best work together. But I would also say that like, I don't even know. So keep in mind, like we've been using office space as a culture for probably, I don't know, 200 years, 150 years. So to say that anyone, myself included, or the two of you, or even Tucker, or any person out there that wants to, suggest they know what's going to happen with office space, you just don't, right? You can't take 100 plus years of utilizing office space and suggest that in the case of 4 years, we've decided that we're, well, nope, like this is what's going to happen going forward. We just don't know. Like it's been 4 years, and 4 years, yeah, may seem like a long time. It's not in the history of office space. And so, we also have AI that is going to have a massive impact on how we work and what jobs are relevant and what jobs are no longer needed and what jobs we don't even know we do need in the future that will be a result of having AI. So I guess my point is that, Brian, to suggest that like offices is like this, like in this death spiral, I don't think that's the case. And John, I think, should every company be back 5 days a week? No, they shouldn't. It's not for everybody, but I think that, executive leaders will fall on, will decide what's best for them. I know Hughes Marino ourselves, you know, we're 5 days a week and we love it. I like being with my team. But anyway, it's a fun project. I call it a project because it's a work in process and it's evolving. And I don't think we're going to know where the pendulum is going to fall for another probably 4 or 5 years.
No, Owen, I love how you were able to just kind of go right down the middle. Switzerland, that answer perfectly. Right down the middle. Just be able to use both sides of the story. Switzerland, right down the middle. Not upset anybody. You know, like,
that's the reality, though. That is the reality. So to take a side on Office Space is hilarious to me because there are so many cases of either side, you know, suggesting I'm right, you're wrong. The reality is, it is Switzerland. That is the world of Office Space right now.
If it walks, what's that saying? If it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Even the people, other than your example of five days in the office, even the people that say, oh, no, we're back. Oh, really? How many days are you in the office? Oh, yeah, we're back 2 days a week.
I agree with you.
Like, so even if the reality is everybody comes back, the vast majority of companies are not coming back 5 days a week, which means that there's a massive amount of real estate that'll never get reoccupied. Even like, I wish I could do the math.
Totally agree.
3 days a week. What does that mean to real estate, demand, right? It's very different than it is today. And there's a lot of real estate that I wouldn't want to work in, especially in the big cities, right? There's a mid-block building. You know, there's a lot of mid-block buildings with windows on the front and back in Manhattan that it's like, might as well work in the basement.
If you have to come in 3 days a week, do you want to go to some dead suburban, boring office campus? Or do you want to come downtown where there's stuff happening? It's fun to be. It's a vibrant community. I'm going to suggest this better be downtown, but I will agree with you that no matter how this settles, and we can revisit this topic on the podcast we have in 4 years from now or whatever, I do believe with Brian that we are oversaturated with office space. There's too much. We've got years and years and years of supply to work through. And some buildings will just, their best course of action will be to take a wrecking ball to them. But that you and I can agree on, Brian.
I think that to your question on the suburbs versus downtowns, I think this is a good way to bring it back to your early conversation on Detroit. The downtowns that do it right and bring residential, because people want to have work-life balance. If they live downtown or they can get there very easily, they would love to be in a place that's vibrant and has all of the different factors, places to go to the movies, places to go to, you know, go to work, go to eat, all of that. But if it's like New York City where the average commute time's over an hour, I think you got to get people living there before you're going to see those buildings fill back up, because they're not going to sacrifice that work-life balance for the benefit of being in a downtown that has amenities.
Yeah. When Owen's saying, where would you rather go, downtown to, you know, a vibrant area, or would you rather go to a suburban office building? And of course, if the commute time to both is the same, then I think people probably prefer to go to the amenity rich kind of cool environment that's a little bit different than maybe what their day-to-day life at home is. But yeah, people want to be near where they live. They want to have the shortest commute that they can, or a commute that's less than 30 minutes, which is that threshold where it starts becoming a lot harder to tolerate. The other thing I wanted to mention is, and you know, we're not going to like say who Owen's really good friend is that he's talking about, but I happen to know who this person is. And when you think about companies that started as remote and are remote first from day one, I think there's a really big difference. Like the type of people you hire, the way that you quantify their performance, their success, their contributions. The reality is that the vast majority of companies that exist today existed before COVID, and they were full-time in person 5 days a week. And then they've transitioned to being, you know, work from home, or now they've come back a couple days a week. And we all know people that work at these companies, and I just don't buy that they are more productive now than when they were in the office 5 days a week. I mean, I see it with Hughes Marino's own team. When people are working from home, which usually is 1 day a week, I notice that people are less productive. Like I can tell when people are working from home, even if I don't explicitly know that they're working from home. and seeing the way that friends and, you know, friends, you know, significant others and different people that I know in my, you know, social community that work these jobs that were full-time in person that now are remote, they're not working as hard. And I think basically everyone realizes that. So I'm more bullish on a remote first company that started as remote and then being able to get high levels of productivity out of their team than I am about a company that was full-time 5 days a week in person, then whipsawed to 5 days at home because of pandemic restrictions and now are 2 days a week. To me, your team's probably working 50% of the hours and like intensity that they were before COVID. And there has to be a way to fix that. Like desperately, as a economy, we need to fix this loss of productivity.
Yeah, there's no better example of that, Tucker, than Salesforce. During the pandemic, Salesforce is like, we're cutting, we're going home. Our people are better at home. They leased this massive property outside of somewhere in Arizona. I think it's outside of Phoenix, called the Trailblazer Ranch, 75 acres, yoga, you know, hotel amenities. We're going to bring all our people together on a frequent basis at this new campus. And within 2 years, they shut it down, right? And now they're bringing people back to the office. The stock had crashed. Productivity was getting destroyed. Innovation was getting destroyed. And they're bringing people back because the company is, in, you know, it's at the time where it really needs its people working as hard as they can and innovating as well as they can. I think, well, the other factor to your point on Owen's point and on the tech community, I don't think I've ever met a VC that has said, you know what? I'd rather pay rent than I'd rather pay more for my company to operate than less. And I think there's an underlying motivation in the VC community, especially in tech. This doesn't seem to be in the life science space as much, at least not in my world, but in tech, where they are very pro work from home because their hold times and their strategies aren't necessarily about productivity. It's about a whole different model in keeping the burn as low as possible and having an exit at some point in the future. And if the technology is good and they can really demonstrate the value of it, their exit is based on somebody else making the company productive, not exactly them. And as you look around, like, of course, the tech community is going to want people working from home. The companies are founded remote. They keep them remote. They sell them remote and make it somebody else's problem. Or they significantly downsize the cost of their real estate to try to create a more healthy company, longer runway, and then sell it and make the productivity issue somebody else's later. So I think there's an underlying motivation in the marketplace with tech that is keeping people at home in that community.
I'll just make one point. I think we have a big city bias. Like in everything we're describing, it's largely true in the major metropolitan markets. And if you look at middle America, we covered this before on the pod. I had pulled some reports out of CoStar to defend it. Everything that we're describing is significantly muted. The same dynamic isn't necessarily at play. There isn't as strong a tech influence driving the office market, you know. Just realize that much of what we're describing is true in Manhattan, San Francisco, Chicago, and there's a big swath of America where what we're describing is much more muted. So let's recognize we have a big city bias in what we're talking about.
There's just more love in the Midwest. That's what it's all about.
Okay, let's end there. You heard it from Brian. There's more love in the Midwest, despite our bias for big cities, where the vast majority of real estate work that we do tends to be, just because there's more companies there. Thanks so much for listening to episode 34, and we will be back in another 2 weeks with the 35th episode. Thanks.